was Gilad Otzman on saxophone playing Everything Happens to Me. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 142. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Gilad Otzman titled Zionism and Jewish Identity Politics, Part 1, and is being released on Monday, April 9, 2012. My interview with Gilad was recorded on Thursday and Friday, April 5 and 6, 2012. And during the first recording, I was interrupted by a jackhammer that showed up outside my window with a road crew about 20 minutes into the first recording. And then the second one, we started while he had, just after he was in a car accident in England. And he was an hour and a half late getting to the interview, and by the time we got to it, it was 3 a.m., so, or by the time we got another hour done, it was 3 a.m. for him, so we decided to cut it short. So this will be a two-part series, and we'll follow up with another hour and a half with Gilad next week. Gilad Otzman was born in Israel in 1963 and had his musical training at the Reuben Academy of Music, Jerusalem, composition and jazz. As a multi-instrumentalist, he plays soprano, alto, tenor, baritone saxes, clarinet, and flutes. His album, Exile, was the BBC Jazz Album of the Year in 2003. He has been described by John Lewis on The Guardian as the hardest-hitting man in British jazz. His albums, of which he has recorded 9 to date, often explore political themes and the music of the Middle East. Until 1994, he was a producer, arranger of various Israeli dance and rock projects, performing in Europe and the USA, playing ethnic music as well as R&R and jazz. Coming to the UK in 1994, Otzman recovered an interest in playing the music of the Middle East, North Africa, and Eastern Europe that had been in the back of his mind for years. In 2000, he founded the Orient House Ensemble in London and started redefining his own roots in light of his emerging political awareness. Since then, the Orient House Ensemble has toured all over the world. The ensemble includes Eddie Hick on drums, Yaron Stavi on bass, and Frank Harrison on piano and electronics. Also, being a prolific writer, Otzman's essays are widely published. His novels, Guide to the Perplexed and My One and Only Love, have been translated into 24 languages. Gilad's latest book, The Wondering Who, is a study of Jewish political identity, and it was published in October 2011. And upcoming shows, as I mentioned, we're going to have Gilad Otzman back for part two on this series on Zionism. And I also plan to have Peter Gorman on soon, and finally, for that matter, to discuss his book on ayahuasca, and of course, Jason Martineau, hopefully Kevin Cole, and Richard Andrew Grove, Robert Forty, and a few others, and donations. This episode is dedicated to Randy, Marcus, Brandon, Christopher, and Sarah. And again, there is a widget up on the front page of the Gnostic Media website for the book and video project, The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms. I had to remove the old one as it had expired, and I put up a new one. And we've gotten about 4 or 5% of the goal on the new one, about probably 18% total. And I really appreciate everyone's contributions on that, and I've put up a list and description and some never-before-released documents up there for people to check out regarding Wasson. And last week in my intro for Joe Atwill's interview, I also explained a lot of what is there up on the website. If you would rather hear it than read it, it is there on last week's episode. I guess I don't need to repeat it today. And for those who've donated towards the new book and DVD project, as I've mentioned before, we will give you credit there for that project rather than here on the show for the podcast. And we do still need some equipment purchases. We're looking for a monitor and a couple of other things that we still need to get as far as equipment, a new camera. And of course, we do our best to provide everything here, or just about everything here, for free. So if you can help with your donations, it's greatly appreciated. And of course, without your support, we cannot continue to do what we do here. And this is listener-sponsored media. Also, up on the website, of course, you can order copies of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, the She Who Remembers audio archives, a t-shirt, or the first 3 years of the Gnostic Media podcast. Of course, my books, Astrotheology and Shamanism, and The Holy Mushroom, and John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, all of which, including your donations, help to continue this programming. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this un-program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me through the web form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Please also check out Tragedy and Hope and the Peace Revolution podcast, and of course, The School Sucks podcast with Brett Vinat, James Corbett's Corbett Report, James Evan Pilato's Media Monarchy, and other commercial-free media, as this one is. And of course, since we do not have commercials, we do require your support to continue doing what we do. And thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Gilad Atzmon, Zionism and Jewish Identity Politics. It couldn't get any more explosive than this, folks. Enjoy. Gilad, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
I'm very delighted to be with you.
It's good to have you on to get back to this most controversial of topics. And in the past, I've had Rabbi Israel David Weiss on the show, and I've had Norman Finkelstein on the show. I've had Professor Shlomo Sand on the show from Tel Aviv University.
Well, good people.
Yeah, and so we've covered a lot of this before, but none of these people had come out to state that they were former Zionists, and really what the implications of being a Zionist mean. And what you do in your book is you really flesh out your own background and how this ties personally to you, and then relate it back into the greater Jewish community. And so your perspective is unique, to say the least, with regard to Zionism. It's quite revealing, going into some of the inner workings of how the Zionists operate, like the Jewish Brotherhood or the Sion, how do you pronounce this?
Sionim.
Yes, exactly, and how they
which
operate.
Is a plural, Sion, singular, and Sionim, plural.
All right, well, let's start off, Gilad, by going into your background a little bit. What is your, let's start off with your educational background.
I grew up in Israel, what you may call an Israeli patriotic background. I would say, at least in my early days, right-wing orientation. At a certain stage, picked up the saxophone. I wasn't actually very young. I was 17 years old. And though before I picked up the saxophone, I thought of a military career. Once I picked up the saxophone, it looked much more appealing for me to live in Chicago, New York, Paris, London, and playing jazz for a living rather than killing Arabs. And I guess that this kind of choice I made to pick up the saxophone had a significant impact on my ethical and philosophical and political views that eventually made me led me to out of Zionism, or led me to drift away from Zionism. I don't see myself as a political human being. I'm more concerned with philosophical and ethical issues. I studied philosophy in university, and postgraduate studies as well here in Britain in philosophy. I'm you can say an international jazz musician. I play all over the world. I'm a very popular jazz musician, and in the last 10 or 12 years, I'm writing a lot about Jewish identity. You spoke about Zionism, and actually I talk about something that is slightly more bored than Zionism. I talk about Jewish identity politics.
More boring, you mean?
Definitely not boring.
Okay.
Something more broad than Zionism.
Okay,
sorry. Something more broad than Zionism. I talk about really Jewish identity politics. I believe that considering the crimes that are committed by the Jewish state in the name of the Jewish people, considering the fact that the Jewish lobby in America and in Britain are pushing for a new world conflict, considering the fact that Israeli airplanes are decorated with Jewish symbols, it is our absolute and necessary right to look into these issues, to ask who are the Jews, what is Jewishness, what is Judaism, what is the relationship between Zionism and the Jews, Zionism and Judaism, Zionism and Jewish ideology. And I've been trying for the last decade, really, to answer these questions. And I think that by now I managed to produce a pretty comprehensive book about the topic. Yet it was very important for me to make the book readable, to make it short. I think I regard this book as my manifesto. So I gave a lot of attention to the shape of it, not just to the ideas, but I wanted to be digestible. And I think that judging by its success, I think that it's very digestible. And this is why I have so many devoted enemies. I'm very happy about it. I want to see them fighting for their cause. And I don't have any doubt that I'm going to win.
What was it like to grow up as a Zionist in a Zionist family?
You see, this is a very common mistake. Israelis are not Zionists. We were not brought up as Zionists. We were brought up as Israeli patriotic, as Sabras. The whole idea of Israel is at least, you know, when I was raised, I don't know what is this, how our kids are brought up in Israel now, but we were brought up with the idea of the negation of the Galut, the negation of the diaspora. So even Zionism was a diaspora topic. Zionism was a promise to make the Jew, the diaspora Jew, into an authentic, ethical, civilized human being. This is what how the Zionists saw their role, at least the early Zionists. Myself, my parents who were born in Palestine, I was born in Israel, let's say. You know, we didn't see ourselves as Zionists. We were the post-revolutionary product. We were the product of the Zionist transformation. So we were brought as secular Israeli patriots, and I must admit that it was a lot of fun. We really believed in our cause. We really believed in our right for the land. And if this is not enough, it was a lot of fun to you know, it's a beautiful place, beautiful sea, beautiful sky, beautiful food, especially Palestinian food. And we were, it's a very, it is a very open society, or at least it was. It was a kind of a society that was at that stage, you know, I'm talking about the 60s, the 70s, at the process of understanding itself. There was still a lot of self-criticism within the Israeli society. By the way, still, you know, I must admit that, for instance, a Haaretz paper is much more advanced than anything I see within the diaspora Jewish discourse. So it was a very interesting experience.
What is the, and going back to this, what is the Jewish Brotherhood and or the Sionim, and how do they operate?
Okay. Sionim are basically people who they're not just ordinary people. It basically refers to Jews who are happy to support and fulfill the need of the Israeli secret services, the Mossad. It is based on racial brotherhood. We are basically referring to the work of Ostrovsky, who wrote a very important book, I think in the late 70s, about the Mossad, how the Mossad operates. He was basically a whistleblower. And he was the first one to write extensively about Sionim. Now, what is interesting about Sionim is that unlike the CIA or the KGB at the time, that would have to establish a very big a station in different countries, like different cities, yeah, a very big network of people who are highly trained. The Israelis didn't need a very big operation, because everywhere around the world they found enough Jews who were willing to support and assist the Mossad in its operation. The word Sayan comes from the roots that should be translated into assistance. They were willing to assist the Israeli secret services.
And so the Zionists do have a global network.
There is no doubt that Zionists have a global work network. But if, again, I don't talk anymore about Zionists, because as far as I can tell, there is a continuum between those who call themselves Zionists, ideological and pragmatic and operational continuum between those who call themselves Zionists and those who insist to call themselves Jewish anti-Zionists.
You see no distinction between those?
Obviously, there are some distinctions, and we can talk about it. In the book, I created, I talk as a philosopher. You know, I'm not working as an anthropologist or as an historian or as a political scientist.
Sure.
I operate as a philosopher. So rather than looking into statistics, I try to produce categories that throw light on the situation and its essentiality. So I, for instance, differentiate between those who identify as Jews between three categories. Those who define themselves as Jews just because they follow the Torah, the Judaism, which is obviously clear. Second category are those who are basically identify as Jews because of ethnicity. They realize that they have Jewish parents and they identify themselves as Jews. But the third category is the most interesting, is those who identify themselves primarily as Jews. And I borrowed this idea from one of the most important early Zionists, Chaim Weizmann, who was later an Israeli president. Chaim Weizmann said in the turn of the 20th century that there are no American Jews or British Jews or Canadian Jews or French Jews. There are Jews who live in America, Jews who live in Canada, Jews who live in France. He basically realized that Zionism is the understanding that you are primarily a Jew. And what I'm saying is that Jews who operate within Jews only cells, even within the progressive discourse and even within the so-called Jewish anti-Zionist, fit nicely into Chaim Weizmann's category, which I regard as the third category of those who define themselves primarily as Jews. People who call themselves Jewish anti-Zionist or independent Jewish voices or Jewish anti-Zionist network. All those people are operating politically primarily as Jews. And this is why they support the tribal discourse primarily. And from that perspective, they are not really different from Zionists. And the meaning of it is very simple. They, within the Palestinian solidarity discourse, their main concern would be the fight against anti-Semitism, which has nothing to do with the Palestinian cause. Always the Palestinian plight. The Palestinians
And interestingly, the Palestinians are Semites.
Exactly. While those who claim to fight anti-Semitism within the Jewish communities probably have very little Semitic
blood,
Semitic origin. Yeah.
Right, and we can go into Shlomo Sand later on in the interview, whom, as I mentioned, yeah. I interviewed. So, for those who have heard that interview, they'll be familiar with some of this topic here.
Yeah, we can talk about Shlomo Sand. I think that he produced a very important text, and actually, I see myself my text as a sequel for Shlomo Sand, Israel Shachak, and Mearsheimer and Walt Work. So it's definitely I will be delighted to talk about Sand. And by the way, I had a very interesting interview with Shlomo Sand, which I have never published. So I was very impressed with him, at least some of his ideas. So basically, what we see is that tribal interests are more significant within the Jewish progressive discourse than universal or solidarity and so on. And it is not very surprising that this is the case because they operate primarily as Jews. They are the third category Jews. In my work, I deal mainly with third category Jews, with those who identify primarily as Jews.
And you say that this network is not a conspiracy, that it's done out in the open. Would you talk about that?
For sure. I don't think that there is any anything as such. I don't think that the Jewish politics is conspiratorial. I think that if people want to talk about the elders of Zion, which is presented as a conspiratorial tale, and it's obviously a forgery, I think that we really do not need.
Let me ask you something about a forgery, because the word forgery means a fake of an original. It doesn't mean to create something that's a fake copy of an original. That's what a forgery means. And there's a book by Douglas Reed called The Controversy of Zion.
Yeah.
And he goes through and he looks at the issue of the so-called forgery of that document and shows that that there's a very strong evidence against it being a so-called forgery.
Yeah, by the way, I'm reading now this book, and it is a book that quite a few people pointed out to me, and you know, there is so much to read and so much stuff to cover, and it is a very interesting text. I actually don't agree with some issues, but definitely very important and certainly a must read.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't agree with every single point you bring up either, but I certainly agree.
By the way, I also don't agree with me on everything. You know,
yeah.
But unlike my fellow Jews, I still didn't get the stage of trying to boycott myself.
So how does Zionism compare to, say, like the Freemasonic networks?
This is the issue. One of the reasons that I don't deal with Freemasons, because this is where I would have to go into this conspiratorial domain.
Right, but well, what I'm comparing is how the Freemasons have a global network established, where if you are in a different country and you need help, you can call to another Freemason, they'll help you. So this is what I'm getting at. And, you know, anybody who's studied history will find history books filled with conspiracies. So, you know, while the mainstream media has sort of twisted things into a conspiracy theory, anybody who removes the fallacies out of the corporate rhetoric, out of the mainstream media rhetoric, will see that certainly there is an intentional effort to manipulate and dumb people down and to mislead them through mainstream media. Anybody who understands logical fallacies can see and understand that.
No, I totally agree. I'm not critical of other fellows who work on this topic. Trying to suggest.
You're just trying to avoid having to go into that with your own work on this topic.
I don't want to deal with, and I don't have to deal with anything that is hidden from the public domain. I'm really analyzing in my text mainstream news, and you know, at the moment we have the Jewish lobby in America, AIPAC and AJC, pushing for a war against Iran, a war that could easily escalate into a nuclear conflict. You know, it is all in the open. You know, so we don't, you know, in Britain, 80%, you know, the Jewish lobby here is bragging about the fact that 80% of British, the Tory, the leading party MPs, are CFI, Conservative Friends of Israel. It's obviously, you know, and you know, try to ask people here in Liverpool or in Hartlepool, how many British MPs are friends of their cities? You know, how many British MPs represent their interest? You know, it will be very embarrassing. But 80% are committed to the interests of a foreign state. Now, we know about
BDS.
Well,
sure, I mean, you know, the state of Israel wouldn't exist without England and the Balfour Declaration.
For sure, but I'm sure that at the time of Balfour Declaration, they didn't receive such a support. And this
sure.
is what, again, this is again something that actually Shlomo Zand, the really, in a very profound manner, spotted a clear twist within the Zionist and the Israeli political perception, while in the early days, Zionism promised to bring a world Jewry to Zion, i.e. Palestine. In the last few decades, it is very clear to the Israelis, at least, that it is much better to keep the Dershowitzes and the Foxman and the Rami Manuels here in Britain, America, and France, because they are much more effective. The mounting pressure on their respective political system, and to a certain extent, this move is very significant because it really hints at the transformation within Zionism.
You're starting to cut out there. All right, so let's just pick up from where we left off yesterday.
And which you have to remind me.
I had asked you about Zionism and how it compares to Freemasonic networks, and then that's about when the jackhammer started. My next question is... how does Zionism compare to homosexual or women's movements?
I make a very important distinction between tendencies or even identities and political identities. So, for the matter, I make a difference between homosexuals and gays. So homosexual is a sexual tendency, and gay is a political identity. In the book I work, obviously I'll obviously talk about the separatist movements which are identified usually as groups who, on the one hand, demand equality, which is totally legitimate, but on the other hand, still insist to maintain an exceptionalist pattern of thought. And obviously, there is a discrepancy between the two. When it comes to Zionism, it is very clear. Zionism, on the one hand, came up with a promise to make the Jews into people like all other people, but on the other hand, it also promised the Jews to maintain the exceptionalist way of thinking. By the way, even if the early Zionists didn't promise, just the fact that they were aiming toward the Jewish state made it into a celebration of chosenness.
Let's talk about the J word. What do you mean by the J word?
J word is a very complicated issue because it is a very elusive concept. On the one hand, we have Judaism, religion. We have ethnicity, ethnic identity, with a clear racial orientation. Although Jews are not a race, the ideology is racist. And we have also national politics. It makes it very complicated to criticize this identity. Because if you you criticize Jewish identity politics, the lame your lame detractors would say, oh, I've never seen you very critical of Islam or Christianity. But there is a big difference, because Islam is not an ethnic identity. Christianity is not an ethnic identity. It's a religious identity. And also, neither Islam nor Christianity are driven by racial philosophy or racist philosophy. Sorry. So it is really, really different. And I'm one of those very few who insist that we must be able to be critical of Jewish identity politics, especially now when AIPAC is pushing for a world war. And AIPAC is a Jewish lobby.
Are Jews, unlike blacks and women, able to leave their Jewish identity behind and disappear into the crowd?
I think that this is a very, very... and it would be very difficult for women or black or many other ethnic minorities to do the same. The true meaning of Jewish assimilation is the capacity to be able to adopt a universal universal attitude and to drift away from chosenness. And many Jews did. We know we are surrounded by liberated Jews, Jews who think in humanist terms and see themselves as ordinary human beings. But you cannot really become an ordinary human being and to uphold Jewish ideology. And this is exactly my criticism of Jewish left.
You can't have your cake and eat it too, essentially. You know, you can't have it both ways.
Exactly.
And so because Jewish identity is a separatist or racist identity, what you're saying is that you can't support humanist ideology and not support the chosen race ideology at the same time.
Obviously, you know, Judaism is tribal, and there is now no problem with it. Judaism is tribal. Jewishness, which is what Jews made out of Judaism, but it's not Judaism, is obviously tribal. Those who say, they call themselves, we are Jewish progressive, or Jews for peace, or independent Jewish voice, they actually want to primarily maintain their tribal attitude within the progressive discourse. And already in 1903, my God, it's very late here, very, very late. It's actually early in the morning. Already in 1903, Lenin spotted that there was a serious discrepancy in Bund ideology. Bund was the Jewish Socialist Party of East Europe, Poland, Ukraine. He said very simply, if you want to join us for real. Strip yourself from this identity.
What is the reaction of Jewish people to different types of good versus bad Jews, let's say? For instance, Einstein versus Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, this is the issue. Jews do not like stereotypes. They really hate it. That's what they say. If you mention Bernie Madoff or Lord Levi or, quite there are quite few candidates for this kind of list of villains who are identified as Jews, you would have a problem. They would be offended, they would be hurt, which is very interesting if you want to understand why it is. It is very, very interesting, and I have some interesting answer for it. However, they don't like being generalized, but I've never heard or never come across a Jew who is hurt when being associated as a Jew with Einstein or Barenboim or Yasha Chafetz and so on. So it is just the bad stereotypes which they don't like. And it is quite natural. However, I elaborated on this issue recently, and it is very interesting. It is very clear the Jews are overrepresented in many of our current blunders, whether it's the financial turmoil, and you find a lot of Jewish bankers, and you have Alan Greenspan, some people would go as far as Milton Friedman, if you look at the war against terror, neoconservatism, you immediately find the Libyan Wolfowitz actually setting the plan. And so on and so on and so on. They are definitely overrepresented. And yet, I would ask what my Jewish bass player or my Jewish wife, or to a certain state, my Jewish kids, have to do with these criminals. My Jewish neighbor, he has nothing to do with it. He is probably subject to the financial turmoil like every other person. He is under danger because Britain was pushed into war probably by those kind of lobbies, you know, or Britain at least was the Labour government was funded by the Jewish lobby here at the time Britain was taken into this criminal war. And you try to understand why is it the Jews are so afraid of this association with these villains. And I came with a very, very simple answer. Because Jews regard themselves as an exclusivist, segregated racial identity, they basically believe that everybody else also see them as a tribe, as a racially driven tribe. So basically, they are so concerned with these stereotypes because they actually project on the goyim around them their own racism.
And speaking of that, and the irony of such, let's get into the word goyim itself. What does the word goyim mean, speaking of stereotypes and sweeping generalizations?
From Jewish perspective?
Yes.
It's not very, very nice. From Jewish perspective, the goy is either a potential murderer. You would hear people like Abe Foxman. I don't quote him. It's not verbatim.
Abe Foxman is in charge of the ADL.
Yeah, sorry, you're right. So you would hear about Abe Foxman or some people within Yad Vashem, scholar within Yad Vashem, who are talking about the inherent anti-Semitism within goyim's mind. Yeah, so Jews,
while they're using anti-goyim terminology to describe it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So
Jews don't, so they don't even see the irony at face value of their own racism while pointing out the so-called racism of the Goyim, but it's their chosen people, quote-unquote, ideology that makes them a point of such things in the first place, is it not?
Exactly. So you would find out that the same people who oppose generalization against Jews are making very vicious generalizations against Goyim. Now, so the Goyim can be, on the one hand, they can be seen as a bunch of potential murderers, but they can also be seen as an instrument that facilitate some Jewish interests.
Okay, so let's cut to the chase on this. The real definition of Goyim, is it not cattle?
It is very possible that some people would see it as
such. Well, I mean, when it's used in the term of Goyim as in non-Jewish subjects to be manipulated towards their own ends, it's like thinking of humans as pack animals or as livestock to as an ends to a mean, the end to a mean, right? Ends to a means, whatever, I can't even say it.
to a certain extent, and from a Jewish political perspective, the Goyim definitely have a role. It's quite frightening. But this is the true meaning of chosenness. You see, people and the universe around you is there to serve you.
And hence why the Palestinians, etc., are used for, house service and doing the lesser work and having their property and homes and things stolen, correct?
It is interesting because initially the Palestinians were seen as a cheap labor that would support the emerging Israeli society. And this was the situation until mid-1990s, where Israel decided to separate itself from the indigenous people on the land. So the Palestinians now do not have a role within the Jewish national project.
Right.
The Israelis would prefer to wake up in the morning and to think that to see that the Palestinians are gone. And this is, by the way, why I argue that Israel is not an apartheid state. Definitely not anymore. If it was an apartheid, it may have been an apartheid at a certain stage, but it is not apartheid now, because apartheid is a system of exploitation of the indigenous, and Israel doesn't want to exploit the Palestinians. It wants them out.
Well, it will exploit them in the way of stealing their property and homes and things like that as they push them out, though.
Exactly. So what we are really talking about is not apartheid, but actually Lebensraum, living space. It's more similar to the Nazi ideology.
Are you a self-hating Jew?
I'm a proud self-hating Jew.
That's funny.
It's significant for me, It's kind of funny. It is funny, but self-hating Jews are pretty miserable. I learned to love myself, hating myself, which is very Jewish. basically, I'm trying to transform this self-loath into an ethical formula. And this is very, very, very different from most political school, Jewish political school around us. But it is very much in line with the work of Christ, with the work of Spinoza, with the work of Otto Weininger. When you look at it, the biggest Jewish humanists were self-haters.
What does it mean to be a Jew at home and a goy on the street?
To my opinion, which is basically, you know, we have to mention it, this is the mantra, the motto of the Jewish Enlightenment, the Jewish Haskalah, as coined by Moses Mendelssohn. For the Reformed Jews who adopted this strange philosophy, it means that they can basically assimilate as much as they manage to hide their true identity. My criticism of this philosophy, and it's very harsh criticism, is that all it means really is lying to God when you are at home, and lying to the goy when you are in the street. And this is very problematic. I get a lot of criticism for saying it, but I don't see any. I cannot see any other way to look at it.
It's and we'll get into this more in a moment, but it's a state of schizophrenia.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it's a state of deceit, and I don't see it at all as an ethical standpoint.
It's not ethical, and it certainly can't be healthy for anybody on either end of that. Jews for peace, Jews for justice, Jews against Zionism, Jews for boycott of Israeli goods. You call it ethnocentric, separatist, peace-loving endeavor. Do either groups of non-Jews identify themselves this way?
No. I must admit that I've never seen Aryan for peace, Aryan for boycotting Israeli good, Aryan for justice. It is. I think the Jews are the only people on this planet who are now operating in the open as racially exclusive groups. Am I right? Can you think of anyone? Can you join
in the United States? You might have, on occasion, African American groups or Latino groups that do this, but certainly, I would say that the largest group who use that would be Jewish.
For sure. And by the way, I would obviously oppose any form of a racist grouping because I'm an anti-racist.
What can you tell us about the creation of the State of Israel?
I'm not obviously I know more than most people about it, but I'm not an expert on issues to do with the Nakba. I don't know the details. I read a few of the books that have been written about it. I'm more interested in issues to do with identity politics and the philosophical standpoint on those issues. what is very clear to me is that Zionism was a promise to make Jews people like all other people. Why Zionism came with such a strange promise? Because Zionism, early Zionism, was extremely anti-Semitic. They identified that there was something really morbid in Jewish culture in late 19th century Europe. And they really wanted to reform, to reinvent the Jew. They realized that if they want to stop the Jew from being a moneylender, a banker, capitalist, bourgeoisie, non-productive, they have to do something radical, and they believe that a settlement project, that if the Jews would have a chance to have their own land, the Jews would transform into something else. And this is the philosophy behind making the Jews people like all other people. Now, there are a few problems here. First, no other people wants to be like other people. So the idea of Jews wanting to be like other people obviously guarantee that they are not going to be like other people. At the most, they would mimic other people. The other problem is that it wanted to make the Jews like all other people, and yet to maintain their Jewishness. But Jewishness meant chosenness, exceptionalism. So it was, the project was doomed to fail. They managed to settle quite to schlep quite a few Jews to Palestine. Israel was founded in 1948. The project was an amazing success, and yet, in spite of Zionism being a revolutionary ideology, its commitment to Jewishness led to the emergence of some vile, racist, barbarian tendency at the very heart of the Israeli society. And this explains why so many Palestinians, actually 75% of the Palestinians, 700,000 Palestinians, were ethnically cleansed in 1948, just 3 years after the liberation of Auschwitz. Just 5 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, Israel set new legislation called the Right of Return that actually blocked, stopped those Palestinians from coming back to their home. This is just 5 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, and 5 years after the end of the war, which means that Israel, just 5 years after that moment of destruction of European Jewry, has itself managed to constitute laws that were not different from Nuremberg laws, that were totally racially driven. This is, by the way, an insight of Hannah Arendt. I just borrowed it from her.
How does one separate Jewishness from Zionism?
I think that Zionism is a private case of Jewishness. We don't have to separate them. Zionism is a set within a larger set. Jewishness.
A lot of.
I'll define it for you. Basically, Jewishness is Jewishness or Jewish ideology. These are terms that I define them. Are different forms of Jewish exceptionalism. Zionism is a private case of Jewish exceptionalism. Now, I differentiate, and it's very important in my work, between three forms of Jewish identification. The first category is Jews who identify as Jews. They identify as Jews because they follow the Torah. It is a Judaic, it's a religious identification. The second identification is those who regard themselves as Jews because of their ethnicity, because they have Jewish parents and so on. The third category is the most interesting, and it refers to those who identify primarily as Jews. And actually, I borrowed it from Chaim Weizmann. Did you speak about Chaim Weizmann before? Yesterday?
Sorry, I had my mute on. Yeah, go ahead and cover it again just to be safe. I think we did, but, you know, it's been 24 hours.
Okay, yeah, and I'm extremely tired here. Chaim Weizmann said that there are no American Jews or French Jews or Canadian Jews, but Jews who live in America, Jews who live in France, and so on.
Right. We did talk about that.
We did talk about it. Yes. Sorry about it. So I thought so. So basically, the third category are those who see themselves primarily as Jews, and this is the people who celebrate Jewishness. The Zionists are definitely primarily Jews, but so are the Jewish anti-Zionists. It's very embarrassing.
Talk about Jewish collective schizophrenia. You say that the reading of the Jewish unconsciousness as the discourse of the Goyim is key to understanding Jewish political activism and collectivism and tribal schizophrenia.
Yeah, it is all based on something that I borrowed from Lacan, actually, from the French psychoanalyst. And he speaks about unconscious, or unconsciousness, because I'm talking here about a tribe, unconsciousness being the discourse of the Goyim. So one good example that Slavoj Žižek brings is when we talk about the case of impotence, it is not really the fear of not functioning in bed, it is actually the fear that you enter the pub, your local pub, and everyone around you knows about you not functioning in bed. When it comes to Israel, especially now with BDS, with the work of Richard Falk about Israeli war crimes, we are all becoming aware of the Israelis are becoming aware of the rest of us see them as a murderous state. And this is a serious dent in their confidence. There is definitely, this is part of the schizophrenia. Obviously, the other form of schizophrenia is just to do with chosenness. When you are believe yourself to be born chosen, you always happen to suspect that it is also possible that you are not chosen for real. Because you're not, for sure, you know.
Very state of going around stating that casts doubt on the very fact of the matter.
Exactly. And this is why the Israeli society as a collective is in a constant state of mania depressia. They move together from peaks of celebration of their greatness. And by the way, there are a few things that they could be proud about or proud of, they've achieved quite a few astonishing things, with the Hebrew, with their language, with their culture. They created a fantasy and they managed to live it, to celebrate it.
At a very high price, to say the least. But
I'm not stopping myself from criticizing Israelis, and as you know, I'm regarded as one of the three or two most harsh critics of Israel. But I must also admit that I think that a lot of my courage to say what I believe and what I think is something that I got from Israel. And there's something that we have to remember. Israeli dissidents is by far more critical, more open, more self-reflective than anything that we see from diaspora Jews.
And that's interesting.
It is very simple. It is a society that teaches you tolerance. It is very similar to the situation in America. You see, in America, you have the First Amendment. Now, we are all aware of the assault on your most basic liberties. But you talk about it, you discuss it, you are concerned with it, you are outraged by it. Now, in Britain, we don't have First Amendment. We don't have a real notion of freedom of speech. And it is needless to say that we are not free at all.
From our perspective, England is about as fascist and as much of a police state as it can possibly get with cameras on every corner.
It is unbelievable. You know, we are saturated with cameras. I'm pretty sure that I have a few cameras in the house as well now. We have kind of a surveillance all over. And we don't even talk about it. And the media here is like the mainstream outlet, the papers, it's a joke.
Oh, sure. Well, here it's a complete joke too.
For sure, but I must tell you, we don't have British information clearinghouse. We don't have British counterpunch. We don't have, whether we like Chomsky or we don't like Chomsky. We don't have a British Chomsky. We don't.
Well, Chomsky isn't very in-depth either.
No, I said. Yeah. I don't agree with Chomsky. I hardly agree with Chomsky on anything. But we don't have academics who are standing up and say what they think and allowing themselves to be critical of the state. We just don't have it. I believe that they had it in Britain, but we don't have it anymore. We don't have Mearsheimer, we don't have Francis Boyle, we don't have Richard Falk, we don't have it. We are just saturated with kind of Dershowitzes.
Have you ever been threatened for your work?
Yeah, a lot.
You take it seriously?
I got used to it. I got used to it. It is very clear that what I'm doing is regarded by a certain lobby as a real danger for the tribe's hegemony, I realized that they are very unhappy. I do know that at a certain few times in the past, I was on kind of top of the list. But I believe in what I'm doing. I'm taking the risk because I think that it is very, very important. I'm not going to live forever. This is something that I realized. And if someone decide to make it into to shorten or to hurt me, or I think that it will be a very silly move because it would prove to the world that
your work would get popular overnight, probably, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but by the way, my work is already extremely, extremely popular. I'm actually tormented by my popularity because, you know, I think that you know that I'm a musician.
Yeah, so you're a jazz musician, a saxophone player.
Yeah, and this is what I'm doing. And
maybe
I'm,
you should send me some music for the beginning of this show.
For sure, I will do it. I'm a very established musician. I'm playing all over the world, and I have ego as a musician. This is what I really practice and try to improve. And I never saw myself as a political figure. I never believed that I would become so popular or as a thinker. I guess that it happened, and I've
speaking the truth is a novel act. Is that what you're saying?
For many lobbies and think tank, speaking the truth is actually a threat. A serious threat, and I understand it, and I have to learn to live with it.
All right, let's talk about the film A Serious Man. Why is that film important to your story?
Good question. Serious Man is an attempt, a cinematic attempt, to understand the complexity of a relationship. It's an attempt to understand the complex relationship between the Jew and the Goy. The Jew and the Jewish society. It is a pretty clever, pretty sophisticated attempt to understand what Jews think about themselves, about ethics, about the religion, about emancipation. Very, very important work of the Coen brothers. I really admire these brothers.
You state that the more Israelis want to secure themselves, the more death and destruction they spread.
Yeah, I talk quite a lot about it. There are two models that I've developed along the years, and I think that they're very important. One is the pre-traumatic stress disorder. Unlike the familiar post-traumatic stress, which is a late reaction to an event, a traumatic event in the past, I argue the Jews as collective, as an ideology, suffer from pre-traumatic stress. They invent a phantasmic situation. They are tormented by it. And their actions would make this traumatic situation into a reality. It is kind of a prophecy that fulfills itself. We see it now with Iran. They invented a trauma, and they are really pushing us now into a war that would turn this trauma into a devastating reality. This is one aspect. You know, so the attempt to secure yourself makes you actually subject to horrific scenario. But the more interesting model is, I don't think that I have a name for it, but I'll explain it. I argue that the more aggressive you are towards the other, the more you are tormented by the possibility that the other may as well be as aggressive as yourself. So if you are extremely aggressive towards a friend of yours, you must believe that people around you may as well be as aggressive as you happen to be. And this could be very frightening. Because if, for instance, you are engaged with a cold-blooded murder, you must be tormented by the idea that there are other people may as well also be murderers. And what we see here is a vicious circle. If the Israelis are pounding the Palestinians with white phosphorus, dropping white phosphorus on hospitals, they must be horrified by the idea that the Palestinian may also be as barbarian as they happen to be. And this is a vicious circle. Because the more hopeless your foe is, the more you are tormented by the fact that this itself doesn't stop you from being barbarian.
More schizophrenia.
More schizophrenia. And this is exactly where the Israelis are. They are, and by the way, America is exactly in the same situation.
that's no joke.
America is, Israel is maybe a microcosmos here. America is exactly in the same situation.
At least we don't have the self-righteous, chosen, racist schizophrenia on top of most of us at the same time.
You don't, but you have a multiracial exceptionalist model. America is an exceptionalist society. It is succumbed to a very similar philosophy of chosenness.
Well, the government has. I would agree with that attitude, and the whole policing of the world nonsense that we think we're righteous to go tell every other country what to do, but. Yeah, you know, many people absolutely question that. But, of course, you do definitely have your rah-rah super patriots that get behind anything that their government tells them to get behind. There is that sort of idiotic faction in the society for certain, but I don't know if they're any longer the majority.
I don't, you know, I'm a philosopher, so I don't deal with statistics.
But right.
Yeah, no, I just don't. I'm not interested in statistics. But but what I would say is that if America is an exceptionalist society, it is definitely, and I think that most Americans would agree with me that it is an exceptionalist society, they would also agree that it is quite young in being exceptionalist. When did you become exceptionalist? After Wilson, First World War? So are you exceptionalist now for 80, 90 years?
You're and really... interestingly, that's all post Federal Reserve and the whole stage that's been established since World War II and the whole economic era since World War I and the whole economic era and buildup since then. And it's all built around that whole mentality, and which was, of course, the takeover of the bankers. And now we're dealing with the comprehensive annual financial report issue on a whole other level of that, an extension of that. But that's all surrounding that whole economic issue at the same time that makes one nice tidy package when we stand far enough back.
Exactly. So the most important thing here is that we agree that you are exceptionalist for 80 or 90 years, and you have to really build your own model of exceptionalism because you are a big country. Nobody teaches you exactly what you do unless you're really looking around. And there are some people around you who are actually practicing exceptionalism for 3,000 years at least. And this is the Jewish lobby. And these are the neoconservatives. So this explains, to a certain extent, the bond between American elite and Jewish intelligentsia. If you really want to be exceptionalist, take us. We will show you how to do it. And this is exactly the true meaning of the American new century school of thought, the neoconservative think tanks. We will tell you how to get this chosenness right. We are doing it for ages, and we are good at it.
Gilad, it's now 3 a.m. in England.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that we could probably do another hour and a half. What do you think about setting up a second episode next week?
Yes.
Okay. And that way you can get some sleep and I can feed my son. And then we're just at about an hour and a half right now for the first part. And we're halfway through the questions that I had for you.
Yeah, for sure. I really enjoy it. Don't misunderstand me, but we have this kind of idiotic accident. Somebody ran into our cars in our car, and you know, took 1 hour and a half to sort it out. So let me see, where are we now? Today we are on the fifth, yeah? No. What? Where are we?
We're on the sixth. Seventh. We're still on the sixth here. It's Friday evening here.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. I can do something on the 12th. And I'm sorry about it today.
It's not a problem. And
my mobile died, so I couldn't even tell you. You know.
Oh, like, yeah. We have enough for a good introduction for a two-part series, anyways. So we might as well give your work the time and let the audience have something to really chew on and to digest.